This is Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. It's been 3 years since the suicide of Sasha Menyukuri, a student at the University of Missouri, but revelations and questions have come to light in the last few weeks. Allegations that Sasha had been raped by at least one fellow student, maybe three members of the football team, and questions about how the university responded. That case is under independent investigation now, but frankly, it's just one case out of thousands. A widely cited study says that 20 to 25% of all women over the course of a college career will be victims of rape or attempted rape. But an award-winning reporting project a few years ago from the Center for Public Integrity in collaboration with NPR News found that colleges and universities, in many cases, have a poor record of handling sexual assault cases. It found problems in reporting, in prevention, in care for victims, and working with law enforcement. Joining us to talk about those findings is one of the staff writers from that project, Kristen Lombardi. She's joining us by phone from New York City. Kristen, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's nice to have you here. A bit later, we'll hear from some folks active on these issues on campuses today. But Kristen, let me ask you about your reporting from back in 2010. How did the issue of sexual assault on college campuses come to be an area for inquiry by the Center for Public Integrity? Take us back.
Well, back in 2008, I was an investigative reporter who had covered sexual assault in institutional settings before, primarily Catholic Church sexual assault cases, and I was speaking at a conference on the challenges of covering sexual assault, and there I met some victim advocates who work on college campuses across the country or who represent student victims in college disciplinary proceedings, and they told me about this shadowy campus judiciary system where schools were actually adjudicating, what I had always seen as a felony crime, rape. And my gut reaction was one of disbelief, a kind of, what do you mean colleges adjudicate rape, question, just completely puzzled. And I took down names and numbers of victim advocates, and I started calling people who might intersect with students who were sexually assaulted. And it really didn't take me long to see, the makings of a pretty good investigation into a seemingly dark secret, especially at that time, on college campuses nationwide. And one of the things that really propelled me were some pretty shocking statistics. I mean, you mentioned the 1 in 5 college women statistic will become a victim of a rape or an attempted rape by the time she graduates. That was true in 2008 when I first started the series, and that was true, that's been true for almost two decades. So that is a crime rate that has not changed. And for me, I thought that was, pretty compelling.
Yeah.
It suggested that this was a very pervasive and persistent problem. And the second statistic that really propelled me forward was this one, and that is only 5% of student victims end up reporting their alleged assaults to authorities, be they campus authorities or to local police authorities. So for the vast majority, they remain silent. And, to me, that just speaks of the fact that this was, especially at that time, it's changed, but especially at that time, this is a very hidden problem. So that's one of the, those are the two main reasons that we decided to pursue this.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, with it being such a hidden problem, as you say, with campuses not perhaps being so forthcoming in their own reporting or their willingness to talk about how they handle these cases, how did you do the research? I mean, how did you find out what's really going on in these students' lives?
Well, it was not an easy process. I mean, one of the things we decided to do was, we wanted to take a national look, and we wanted to get beyond isolated cases on individual campuses and kind of connect dots and see larger commonalities and trends in these cases that might suggest systemic problems or failures. And so one of the ways we did that immediately was to create a survey. And we did it, through very traditional social science methods, and we surveyed rape crisis centers or crisis service programs and clinics that were either on campuses across the country or connected to college campuses across the country. And we surveyed 152, and they represented every region of the country, every kind of school, be they public or private, small or large. We took a cross section and did a random yet representational survey, and they really helped us lay the groundwork for our reporting, those survey responses. We also examined 10 years' worth of complaints and lawsuits that were filed against schools by students, as well as records in individual cases. You know, students, they can either sue under Title IX in federal court, a university, for mishandling their rape complaint, or they can file grievances or complaints, formal complaints, with the Education Department. And we actually FOIA'd 10 years' worth of complaints with the Education Department to see what students were complaining about and how the Education Department responded.
FOIA'd, you got records through the Freedom of Information Act.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
We interviewed dozens of people, hundreds actually, including 50 college administrators, and, you know, really made a point to talk to people who were familiar with this problem. So not just college administrators, but people on hearing boards who served on hearing boards, academic deans, campus police officers, local district attorneys, anybody who intersected with the campus adjudicatory process. And then we also interviewed 33 female students who reported to schools being sexually assaulted by fellow students.
Okay, so let's get to it then. According to your research and your conversations, your interviews, your surveys, what did you find? How does a university typically respond when there's an allegation of sexual assault? If a student does become one of those 5% who reports their assault to authorities, what happens next?
Well, I think overall we found that students who were deemed responsible for sexual assault on campus, which is the equivalent of guilty in the college disciplinary process, often face little or no punishment from school administrations, while their victims' lives are frequently turned upside down. We analyzed data from the Justice Department and found that responsible findings, which is, you know, a school believes that an alleged or accused student committed a sexual assault, rarely leads to punishment like expulsion or even suspension. And meanwhile, the student victim almost invariably would drop out of school or transfer altogether, often out of fear of having to see their alleged assailant on campus. And we found a lot of other troubling aspects with the process. Students who reported being the victim of sexual assault on campus, they often faced a host of barriers that left them feeling victimized again. For instance, some administrators would discourage them from pursuing a rape complaint and say the process is very hard, you're going to be under a microscope, you probably don't want to do this. Some schools failed to investigate the complaint altogether, or they didn't present a basic sexual assault policy to the student. And so those students, they didn't even go through the process because they hit too many barriers, and that was actually more common than not. But victims who went through the campus judiciary process, they actually had a hearing, and it was adjudicated, and there was a disposition. They often encountered very mystifying disciplinary proceedings. They may have been classified as witnesses to their own assault, so they weren't entitled to sit through an entire hearing and to hear what was said. You know, they were only allowed to come into the hearing as a, quote, witness, or they were forced to go through mediation or off-the-record negotiations with the accused student. And some students even had gag orders placed on them where they were told not to talk at all about what happened to them.
I guess I'm confused about why the universities are doing all of this with, as you said, this is a felony crime. Why are these cases not simply referred to law enforcement from the very first moment they're reported?
I think that's a question everybody wonders when they hear about colleges handling rape cases at all, and I certainly did. But we found out two things. It's very important to note that the biggest reason why schools handle these cases is because they're required to do so by federal law. and that federal law is Title IX. When a student comes forward and alleges sexual assault, a school has to investigate the claim, and it has to take action to eliminate any harm if it determines that, you know, harm has occurred. Title IX doesn't dictate or lay out how schools must respond, and so a lot of schools use their existing student misconduct process to adjudicate these cases. And that's a process where schools, you know, will adjudicate any form of student misconduct, such as plagiarism, you know, or cheating, or other disciplinary projects or problems like maybe drinking on campus. So it's an interesting process to adjudicate these cases in the first place. But it is important to note that they're required to look into these cases. At the same time, you know, when we talked with college administrators, it was clear a lot of administrators, expressed frustration over the fact that, you know, they feel that they are adjudicating these cases almost by default because, you know, the criminal justice system doesn't often take acquaintance rape cases, which is the typical campus sexual assault case. Mm-hmm. You know, many students we interviewed went to local police authorities. Actually, the majority went to the either they went to campus police that, you know, were not that were authorized as police officers. You know, they were sure. They were police officers, or they went to literally the local police because they wanted to pursue criminal charges. And what happened was that the district attorneys declined to prosecute, and many district attorneys told us that they don't, that these cases are very, very difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. They involve, the allegations of campus sexual assault often come down to he said, she said accounts. It's not as if the question of whether or not a sexual act occurred is a question. You know, it's a question of consent. Mm-hmm. And there's rarely physical evidence. There's rarely eyewitness testimony. Alcohol and drug use plays a very central role and can complicate things further. The alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator typically know each other. And so they decline to take the cases. And students go through the campus judicial system almost as a last resort.
You mentioned in the story, in fact, a headline on your series of stories talked about a culture of secrecy. You mentioned that some students who submitted to this campus judicial process were ordered not to talk about it. What is this culture of secrecy about? Why would the universities want to keep all this so quiet?
Well, there are plenty of people that believe that, universities, try to keep these cases quiet because it's bad, it's bad for their reputation, right? Mm-hmm. We found that problems arise because the campus judicial process is by definition a closed process. It's not like the civil courts or the criminal courts where you can walk into a courtroom and you can sit there as any member of the public and watch the proceedings unfold before you. I mean, that doesn't happen.
So a closed process that might make sense in like a plagiarism case being adjudicated by a school panel, but something different than a trial in a rape case.
Yes, very different. Required confidentiality complicates matters for alleged victims. That because the process is closed, it requires confidentiality. And, you know, for victims, some schools took that so far that they had policies that acted as gag orders on students where they were threatened with punishment, actually, if they talked about their cases with anybody. And we wrote one of our main cases featured a woman from the University of Virginia, which had a pretty stringent confidentiality policy that's since been changed and amended. She took their confidentiality policy so much to heart that she didn't even tell her mother that about her disciplinary hearing. Other schools have kept the alleged victim in the dark, like I mentioned before, by classifying the victim as a witness. So she's not allowed to even sit in and participate in the hearing. Or they keep hearing results you know, at the time, a lot of schools kept hearing results from victims. They weren't across the board. These weren't practices across the board, but they recurred enough to suggest a problem.
Kristen, we're almost out of time. I want to ask this about this series, which we should note you wrote and reported along with Kristen Jones and some others. You drew a lot of attention to the issue. The series won a bunch of awards. I know you're now reporting on other subjects for the Center for Public Integrity, but can you assess the long-term impact of those reports in the 3 or 4 years since these reports came out? Has anything changed?
I would say that these stories have had some pretty decent public policy impact. The issue itself has been raised to a level that I don't think I even imagined at the time. Pretty soon after the series, in April 2011, so a year after the series, the Education Department's Civil Rights Office, which is the office charged with enforcing Title IX, unveiled its most thorough guidance on how colleges and universities must respond to student complaints of campus rape. It's a 19-page Dear Colleague letter. It says schools have an obligation under Title IX to investigate student complaints and to take prompt and effective action to end harm. And it's spurred change at schools across the country. At the same time, the Civil Rights Office has become a lot more proactive and aggressive in their enforcement, and they've done their own sort of compliance reviews of universities, and there have been 11 such reviews since our series came out. At the same time, the president signed federal legislation combating campus sexual violence as part of the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, and that's going to set minimum national standards for how colleges and universities must handle these complaints. And then very, very recently, the president created a White House task force on campus sexual assault. So the issue has been, the awareness around the issue has been heightened tremendously, and there's been a lot of change, and just more change is going to happen as we go.
That's Kristen Lombardi. She's a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, talking about her landmark reporting a few years ago on campus sexual assault. She joined us from New York City. Kristen, thanks for taking some time to be with us this morning.
Thanks so much, Brian.
When we come back, we'll talk about this issue in the present day. We'll explore what some universities are doing, including a conversation with a student leader at KU. And we'll also ask whether they could be doing more. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about campus sexual assault in the light of allegations that the University of Missouri didn't respond adequately to information that a sophomore who took her own life 3 years ago had allegedly been raped by members of the football team. We're asking how serious a problem this typically is at colleges and universities and what's being done about it. Joining us now is Anne Hedgepeth. She's Government Relations Manager for the American Association of University Women. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. Anne, good morning and welcome.
Thank you for having me, Ryan. I'm glad you all are talking about this important topic.
Well, we're glad you can join us. And also from the campus of the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Emma Halling. She's the Student Body Vice President and Co-Chair of the Campus Title IX Committee. She's joining us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio. Emma, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning and happy snow day.
Yes, we're glad you could make it into the studio. And let me ask you, we heard before the break about reporting that was done a few years ago that said universities' response to the problem of sexual assault on campus has been inadequate, that a culture of secrecy surrounds these cases rather than one of transparency and proactive activity. Is that your observation? Is that still the case today?
Brian, I think that is an accurate assessment of what's going on. Not all schools are doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And we know it's a tough thing to navigate. Schools have a lot of unique circumstances to consider about their student body or how residential they are or whatever is going on. But at the end of the day, we do know that there are some things that every school can do, like have a Title IX coordinator, someone who's in charge of paying attention to these things, like using the correct standard of evidence in their disciplinary proceedings, and like accommodating students to rearrange classes or deal with housing concerns, whatever it might be. Those are things that all schools can be doing, and they aren't necessarily. We also hear often from students that, you know, schools' response to their complaints or to, you know, an incident on campus isn't always particularly sensitive to the needs of student survivors, and that can really taint the process then from the moment that a student comes forward, if they do come forward. And as Kristen mentioned, those numbers of reporting are so low, and that remains the case. AUW has been working on these issues for a long time, since Title IX was put in place, and we continue to hear some of these same things happening at schools across the country. We really need to make sure that changes.
I wonder why the emphasis on the response of colleges and universities, and I asked a similar question to Kristen, isn't this a law enforcement issue? University offers classes, they provide food and housing in some cases, but why is the school dealing with allegations of rape?
Schools are obligated to provide a hostile-free environment, one that's equitable to all of their students. And what we find is that sexual assault and sexual harassment on campus majorly changes the climate on campus. And when students don't feel safe on campus, they don't learn. Kristen mentioned it herself that a lot of survivors drop out. They don't complete their education. And schools do need to do as much as they can to ensure that students are safe. Part of that is dealing with sexual assault on campus in a way that ensures that, you know, survivors have options. They can continue their education. They have a way to move things through disciplinary proceedings. None of those things, though, preclude the criminal justice system from also acting. The Department of Education has been clear about that these things can happen simultaneously and can provide different remedies. One's about, you know, your access to education, and the other is about what sort of criminal options there are.
Emma Halling, you've been speaking out suggesting that KU could be doing more. Tell us a little bit about what the university does do to educate students about sexual assault.
Yeah, currently KU is pretty ahead of the game in terms of educating students about sexual assault. We do have a online training that is issued to the entire student body every year. However, the number of students who have been taking that have declined since the first year that it debuted because there's been some misunderstanding about whether they need to be taking it each year. It's also not the most engaging content material. Currently, there aren't any questions to make sure that students are actually engaging with the content or retaining any of it and actually processing it. So what I'm looking to do is improve that information presentation to students, both through an online component and an in-person component, because much of the research about how students learn indicates that they need to be confronted with it in an online module, but also have that reinforced later in person.
You know, a lot of attention was focused on KU since last fall when there was a report on the Al Jazeera America TV network about campus assault, and it included video of a group of KU students drinking and partying and talking about, in one case, talking about frequently waking up in the morning, not remembering who they might have had sex with. How did that report go over on campus?
Yeah, it caused some waves that were really unpleasant, I think, especially for the administrative response. Any coverage like that is kind of embarrassing for a university, and you definitely want to be careful to issue that statement that this is not the values that our institution holds. However, as students, we were quick to identify that, of course, this is happening. I'm familiar with this culture. Even if I'm not in that particular subgroup on campus, I see this kind of behavior all the time. It really just reified what students already know about students' behavior about sexual consent, alcohol, things like that. One of the things that we're running into is we are the abstinence-only generation. We did not necessarily get the best sex education in school. We were not confronted with information about what consent is before we got to college, quite possibly. And we are also one of the most anxious generations that has yet to debut on the college scene. And we tend to use alcohol as an anesthetic for those anxieties, and the combination of those two as we have seen, can be pretty lethal.
Let me ask you, Anne. Emma is lifting up a whole culture that goes beyond a particular atmosphere at KU, but the way kids are growing up these days, the way they talk about sex, the way they learn or don't learn about consent, are you seeing similar problems on campuses across the country?
You know, I think that generally the intersection of all things that are happening on college campuses, you know, it could be attitudes, it can be the influence of alcohol and drugs, it can be what the, you know, what the athletic culture on campus, whatever it might be, those things definitely come together to create on a college campus, you know, the unique set of circumstances that schools need to deal with. But really, I'm talking about the prevention activities that can take some of those things on and address them and hopefully work with students to improve the climate, to talk about attitudes, to provide accurate information, as sort of a sex ed and what resources are available on campus and what sort of opportunities they have. I think those are all really important things that AUW is optimistic will come out of the newest law that passed that Kristen alluded to, the that was a part of the Violence Against Women Act. It's really going to make sure that schools are doing more on the prevention front, addressing, you know, some of these things that students come to campus with or the way that colleges operate, to see if we can tackle sexual assault before it occurs, and so that we're not only focused on some of these hiccups that are occurring in the disciplinary process or in the ways that we're responding.
Let me ask you, our listeners, to join the conversation. Mm-hmm. Are there particular changes in policy or changes in attitude that you think colleges and universities can undertake to protect students from sexual assault, to improve the situation in our local colleges or in America and colleges in general? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're talking with Anne Hedgepeth of the American Association of University Women and Emma Halling, who's a student body vice president at the University of Kansas. Anne, let me ask you to continue that thought. What is the Sexual Violence Elimination Act of 2013? You mentioned it was part of the Violence Against Women Act. What does it actually require?
So it's going to do a few things on campus. One of the things is to sort of update a law that schools are already operating with, the Clery Act, which is about their crime reporting that they do on campus. We're going to get a little more information about things like domestic violence and stalking and dating violence that occurs on campus. Those statistics, obviously, they work within the framework of reporting. And so some crimes are underreported. We've heard already that that's really the case with sexual assault. But as much information as we can glean that can help improve the situation on campus. So we'll get more information about that. We're also going to see that institutions are going to bolster their prevention education programs as a result of this new law that's for students, but then also for employees who are a part of these services, these disciplinary proceedings, who are part of campus law enforcement, are going to hopefully get some more information and the right kind of training to make sure that we are tackling prevention and that we're providing the right kind of response. Sort of, I think we're talking about gearing this towards a climate shift. We're talking about minimizing sexual assault, about, you know, treating this more seriously on college campuses. Finally, we'll also see that schools are making their policies about sexual assault, about the proceedings that then occur, what your resources then are for survivors. Those things are going to be public now, and every student's going to have more access to them. Go on any school's website, and sometimes it's only one click away. Other times it's buried somewhere, what sort of policy they have and what would really happen if you came forward with a complaint. We really want to bring that out of the shadow, too. That information can be power for students.
We've mentioned several times Title IX of the Federal mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act. Emma Halling, you are the co-chair of KU's Title IX committee. What does Title IX have to do with campus sexual assault? I guess I've always thought about Title IX in the context of athletics and providing equal sports between women and men on campus.
Yeah, you're definitely not alone in that. But even though the language of Title IX is very simple, that there shall not be gender discrimination in higher education, the impact is really sweeping. And the issue with sexual assault is that it is such a gendered issue. Women are overwhelmingly victimized by it rather than men, that it becomes an issue of a hostile environment within higher education. So if campuses are not addressing sexual assault, are not addressing domestic violence, stalking, things like that, they are in effect creating a hostile environment for the women students who are trying to pursue their educations.
I wonder, why, Emma, do you think this problem is so intractable? I mean, in your experience as a student, nobody wants to see young women being assaulted. No one thinks they shouldn't get help or protection. What's keeping a solution from really being achieved here?
Yeah, There's really two main causes, I think, one of which is the devaluation of young women and the lack of people's inclination to believe them when they talk about things. A lot of times, especially in the past, whenever a woman said that she was sexually assaulted, said that she was raped and was looking for help, oftentimes the first reaction was to just attempt to discredit the survivor and say that she was covering up behavior that she didn't want people to know about, that she couldn't possibly know what she was talking about, or that if she was drunk, it wasn't because, you know, it wasn't rape because she couldn't consent because she was drunk. It was because she was drunk that she is an unreliable witness. Another reason is that there's really a tendency for these things not to get reported because people want to deal with them privately. Social groups especially tend to be very insular on these issues, and that's one of the biggest barriers. College is a very social time. You're trying to figure out who your friend groups are, who your friend groups are going to be once you graduate, and you don't really want to make waves within your individual social group. And so the tendency is to not say anything if you know that there's been a sexual assault in your friend group, or if you know that there's a particular man in your social circle who is victimizing women, you don't want to be the one to disturb the peace. So it's really about finding ways to shift this culture, and especially to encourage men to be accountable to other men on these issues.
If you have questions or comments for us today on Central Standard here on KCUR, you can call 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. I guess I wonder, Anne, and maybe some listeners are wondering as well, is there a point at which students have to accept some of the responsibility here, both the students who find themselves in tenuous positions, dangerous situations, bystanders perhaps, who are not stepping up to stop sexual assault or to report it after it occurs?
I think that is an important thing to point out, which is that the type of prevention training, the education, the culture shift we're talking about is really something that everyone plays a part in. It can be bystander training, which is a part of the new campus SAVE law. It's also the information that's out there and becoming more available. AEW has resources for survivors on our website so that if you'd like to file a complaint or want to know more, you have a place to go. The Department of Education provides that information. Student advocates can help you. And I think some of these organic groups that are stepping up and working with survivors, working with students, are important to making a shift in our attitudes. And that type of responsibility where we're all taking care of each other and identifying the problem and figuring out ways to end campus sexual assault on campus is really important. And I think something that all of the attention starting with the reporting that Kristen did can really contribute to a shift that can be taking place.
And the American Association of University Women has been lobbying on these issues now for some years. Are there more changes that you'd like to see in terms of legislation, or is this more a matter of applying existing laws at this point?
I think we're hopeful. AUW is hopeful that the new law that passed along with the Violence Against Women Act will provide some additional tools. I know that we're calling for some additional guidance, best practices, more resources from the Department of Education to help schools. They're saying we need more information about this, or survivors are saying we're not entirely sure how to file a complaint. Those are things the department can help with. We also know that schools can be going beyond some of these requirements and doing things like climate surveys so that we aren't just restricted by who's reporting on these issues. And at the end of the day, I think that, joining student groups like I think the ones that Emma works with, I think that working with a group like the American Association of University Women, we have 800 college and university partners, we have branches on campuses, can provide a place for organic ideas, things that schools may want to do that are, unique to their population. Those can grow out of conversations taking place on college campuses and fostered by advocates who've been paying attention to some of these issues.
I did want to ask, we've been talking throughout the hour about women as victims of sexual assault. Are there men who are victims in sexual assault cases on campuses as well, or other communities?
Absolutely. And I think the stigma that's attached with coming forward, not only as a survivor, but in particular as a male survivor, it means that sort of the breadth of that particular issue is still, maybe not widely talked about. And our, response needs to be, address and be there for all survivors. Assuming that all sexual assaults happen in some one way, it gets us in trouble. I think that you hear from a lot of survivors that school responses may have assumed certain things about the way things should have gone, and that's, I think, a number one thing that we need to be looking out for is the way that we stereotype or assume that these incidents occur. And if we, can approach things in a different way, we can sort of contribute to that shift, that change in culture.
You know, one reason we're talking about this now is the case at the University of Missouri of Sasha Manukuri. And that situation, as was first reported on ESPN, it was as much about the mental health treatment she received and the response of the athletic department around her swimming scholarship and so on, as about the response to the sexual assault itself. The University of Missouri was unable to comment while that investigation is pending. But let me ask you, Emma, over at KU, for survivors of sexual assault, what kind of help or support is there?
Yeah, there are a lot of accommodations that we've previously mentioned that can happen for survivors. You know, if you are in a class with a person who assaulted you, you can have your class schedule changed or their class schedule changed. You can have housing arrangement changed. You can have a campus escort if that's what you need in order to feel safe. One of the things that KU has been doing, particularly in response to this Mizzou case, has been providing additional materials for our mental health and healthcare workers so that they know how to react when a student comes to them with this sort of information. There's kind of a murky area between patient client confidentiality and mandatory reporting laws, and we're trying to help our healthcare workers navigate those so that we're not losing any victims in that shift right there. There's also a social network that's really starting to emerge about with victims, supporting victims on these issues. Sometimes knowing that I am not alone in this is one of the most powerful things that can occur for a victim. And I think that's another reason that we're seeing this this conversation emerging more and more is because social media has really changed the way in which women view campus sexual assault. It used to be an isolated incident, but now there have been powerful photo series. There's the Know Your Nines campus Twitter account, things like that, that are helping women to realize that they are part of a larger movement.
Emma, we'll have to have the conversation continue there. I wish we did have more time. There's a lot more we could talk about. I do want to thank Emma Halling. She's student body vice president and co-chair of the Title IX Committee at KU, and also Anne Hedgepeth of the American Association of University Women. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Brian.
Special thanks to Kansas Public Radio and Lawrence for their help today. You can subscribe to our podcast or learn more information about our show at the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Stay with us now for up to date for the latest on the snow and much more. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Suzanne Hogan and Kate Baxendale. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.